think about when we see film that might reference or include something to do with the struggles of rural communities in Africa, especially, and the focus is in some ways sort of what they are. You know, they are poor rural people in such and such a country. And the distinction of somebody, of having people who understand that community a bit better, that might be able to take us inside that community, is to change that question from not what they are, but who they are.
When you're aware of your own implication in these landscapes that you would never see, and you see what they really are, I think that is the beginning of action.
Everything started when we discovered these beehives in the rocks. And from there, the curiosity happened. Who is the person behind this? Who makes this? And to meet this person and to realize how special she is was the main inspiration to start all of this, to go in the direction that it's now.
What's up, guys? You're tuned into the Eyes on Conservation podcast. I'm your host today, Serena Simons, bringing you some awesome coverage from Sundance 2019, following in the footsteps of last episode's Sundance coverage by Kristen Tiesch. I will be interviewing several filmmakers that I encountered on my awesome time in Sundance. It was such an amazing experience, crazy but amazing, just getting to be in the presence of so many creative, inspiring people. And so on today's episode of the show, we are going all the way to Macedonia, back to Malawi, and then pretty much all over the world again. So covering Honeyland, which is a documentary, I'd call a pseudo documentary, because it was so cinematic and beautiful, about a woman, Hatija, who is living alone in an abandoned town in Macedonia, near the capital, but far away from everyone. And she's solo beekeeping in this beautiful traditional way, and sustaining herself and her mother the best way she knows how, until a family shows up and kind of disrupts everything. And then we're also going to talk to the filmmakers of Anthropocene, which is a new documentary that is so gorgeous, so timely, and so important. And that film, it just, I think about it all the time. I think about the imagery that I saw in it, but that is talking about how humans are now creating the Anthropocene. We have left the Holocene epoch and are now in the Anthropocene, meaning humans are now changing the earth in geologic time. We have now made enough of an impact to have really created our own epoch, which is just fascinating. So we're going to be talking to those filmmakers, as well as a very special interview with Chiwetel Ejiofor, who you might know from various movies, including 12 Years a Slave and Children of Men. He's going to be in the new Lion King movie. But this is his directorial debut, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, who he also stars in. And we're going to be picking his brain about the film, which follows a young boy in Malawi during a terrible drought in the early 2000s. And by the way, this is based on a true story, who goes against all odds and learns how to build a windmill for his village and save them from devastation and death. It's beautiful, and I really encourage you all to see it. It's on Netflix, so there's no excuse. And I'm really excited about today's show. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you find it as informative and intriguing and interesting and inspirational as I did. And this is my coverage from the 2019 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah.
The Anthropocene is the time in the geological record when humans have moved the planet outside its natural limits.
Humans go from being participants in the whole Earth to being a dominant feature.
Dominating the oceans, the landscape, agriculture, animals.
It could be a full-scale catastrophic change.
Um, So I guess I'll start by just if you guys could introduce yourself. We're going to be talking about the film Anthropocene, the Human Epoch, and I just saw it last night, and so it's pretty fresh in my mind, but if you guys could introduce yourselves.
So I am Jennifer Batchwal, the co-director of Anthropocene, the Human Epoch.
And I'm Nick DePoncier, another co-director, along with our friend Edward Bertinsky, and also the director of photography of Anthropocene, the Human Epoch.
I guess, so my first question is, the scale of this film, it took you guys 4 years to make this film. I guess, how did you do that? How did you manage to do that?
I'm a big proponent in filmmaking of the idea that you can't really learn to make films. You can just learn to make the film that you're working on at the time and its own specific universe and set of rules and demands from the subject matter. In a way, you can almost not get bigger in scope than taking on the whole planet as your subject and also thinking in geological time. So we knew from the very beginning this was a very ambitious undertaking and was going to take a collaboration among three filmmakers and all of our wonderful teams, and also a big window of time to research for almost a year, certainly working with the Anthropocene Working Group of scientists and their research, and then thinking and iterating how to translate some of the ideas of the things that they're researching into visual language and into experiential scenes in the film. It's also a project that is not just a film. It has a art museum exhibition component, which we've already successfully launched in Canada and will travel around the world. It's going to Italy in May. And it's an education component. It's been two books. There are 360 VR films. There's augmented reality. So we also knew that for such an ambitious topic, we wanted to have a lot of different windows into the themes and the scenes that we were going to investigate.
So I guess the argument of the film is that we've left the Holocene epoch and we've entered the Anthropocene epoch. And you guys were talking about the research that you've been involved with in covering this and using the documentary as a way to kind of visually tell that story rather than doing like a long form research paper that nobody's going to read. So you have this beautiful film that hopefully a lot of people will have access to and see. What drew you guys to such a heavy topic? I know that this is very, I'm interested in this because I feel like the story of the Earth and what humans are doing to it is kind of like the most important thing we can talk about and work towards. But what drew you guys to wanting to tell this story about the planet?
Well, I mean, this collaboration with Ed Bertinsky, the photographer, started 13 years ago with Manufactured Landscapes, and we made Watermark together. This is kind of the third. It wasn't intended that way. It just sort of organically happened. And the film was very much inspired by the research of the Anthropocene Working Group scientists who, for 10 years, have been gathering evidence about human impact on the systems of the Earth. And they were tasked by the International Commission on Stratigraphy to do this research to determine whether the idea had any merit at all. Like, are we in the Anthropocene epoch? Have we left the Holocene? And over the course of 10 years, they pretty much unanimously have come to the conclusion that humans change the Earth and its systems more than all natural processes combined, and they have all of this research to prove it. So we knew that the film was going to follow their research categories and explore them and try to find the most sort of powerful or salient examples also of their categories, so anthroturbation, human tunneling, terraforming of the Earth, which is changing the Earth's surface for agriculture, industrialization, urbanization, technofossils, which are human-created materials that persist in the biosphere, like plastic, concrete, aluminum. They estimate that the technosphere is 30 trillion tons of material, the built environment, etc., etc. So we knew we wanted to do that. And I would say that for most people, I think especially people living in the global north in urban environments and cities, they kind of think of civilization as one thing and nature as another thing, that, you know, you go into nature to hike or go on a canoe trip or something or go for a walk, and then you go back to your life in the city and that's life. When in fact, the two are so inextricably connected, and everything we do in the city every single day is taking from nature in some way. And we have been doing that forever, but now the rapidity and scale of our taking has pushed into another limit. And I think that the idea of Anthropocene is allowing people to be aware of how much impact we have had as a species, and the fact that we need to collectively find a way to pull the Earth systems back into a safe place for all life, for not just us, but all other life on Earth, because we are all integrally connected. So the idea was to try to make that concept that, you know, when we started this, nobody had heard of that word. Nobody knew what that word meant. Now it's starting to pervade more and more into public consciousness, an awareness of our impact.
Do you think that there's a way to shift out or basically change the direction that we're headed deeper and deeper into this Anthropocene epoch where we are just taking and taking and we've dug ourselves too far? Or do you think that there's, because the film, it doesn't show the positive of like what humans are doing. So it's a lot of showing how we are exploiting and how, like on the extreme scale that we are exploiting. But it's so matter of fact, and it's so, you have to think about that. You have to think about your own personal impacts. But on such a small scale as one individual who sees the film, you know, or the collective of people who see the film, what the takeaway is, of course, you know, we need to stop these processes, but do you think that we are too far gone as a species?
The film is heavy, obviously, and it takes us to places that are often devastating to witness, just as they are devastating on the environment that they are in. But it is absolutely an act of hope that we are not finished, that the Anthropocene, you might argue about when it started, but that how it ends is still very much up for grabs. And that's the ambition of the work, is to raise consciousness, is to, as you described very deliberately, not be prescriptive and not be an environmental rant and not be fixed in the meaning of visiting these places, or try to reduce them in a way that doesn't acknowledge their complexity, but allows each individual viewer, hopefully, in the openness of that approach of filmmaking, to have a more singular and personal and hopefully more profound potential for learning and transformation. And then, of course, the ideal is that whatever that new learning is does translate into some kind of change of action, change of behavior, on an individual level and at a collective level.
Can I just add to that, which is that, you know, the film is not all negative. Like, there's something very ambiguous about the tusk burn, which is the opening and ending of the film, because it's an incredible tragedy when you think about the deaths of 10,000 elephants, when you think about the global demand, the illegal trade in ivory, the desperation of poachers, the middlemen and the middle people, I guess, who are fencing that and the demand. Like, on the other hand, it is an incredible act of hope to burn all of that ivory, and it feels like an apocalyptic moment, but in fact it is a positive thing to say, there should be no market for ivory, period. There's no such thing as a legal market. Ivory belongs to elephants, period. And that was a lot of, you know, that was worth, what was that, Nick? $150 million US. You know, that was a lot of money. and they burned it. That was an act of hope. Going to the Zoological Society of London and the London Zoo with these animals that are extinct, these species that are extinct in the wild or critically endangered, and the way that they are cared for by people who are actively working to reintroduce these species, to protect them. When you go to even underground farming in a bomb shelter, you know, finding new lands, finding new ways of farming that don't involve, you know, pesticide use and huge swaths of land. And so they're at lithium, you know, lithium is an alternative for, you know, to fossil fuels. So they're all through I would say, sort of evidence of our species' ingenuity. Like we've come so far, we've been so successful, that we have the capacity to succeed. We also have the capacity to understand that we have to mitigate our impact, or we'll be gone along with everything else.
And I think that's one of the most beautiful contradictions of just like human species, is that we are capable of doing such devastation, but we have these giant brains that can do amazing things, and we have the potential. So my last question is, what do you guys think people should be doing better as individuals? And, you know, how do you think we can get more forward-thinking people and using our big primate brains to make some real change on the planet? And what do you think that's going to look like?
I think the answer to the question of what we should be doing is as different as there are different people who need to answer that question, because all of us have different capacities and interests and talents that we can bring to these solutions. So I don't think there is one answer beyond to be aware, to be engaged, to participate. People who are inclined to throw their hands up in despair will not be part of the solution. And the scientists have told us that we are really running out of time for a lot of these questions. There is no more carrying capacity on the planet that we can outsource some of these problems to. It's all right now in our faces all the time, given our population and our unprecedented footprint. So it's really a crisis time that we all need to participate in the solution.
Yeah, and I would also argue there that we have to support the people who are actively working for change. Now we are all implicated. There are critiques of the Anthropocene. There are critiques of it that say it should be called capitalocene. That actually there's a very small group of people who live in the global north in the developed world who are responsible for most of the destruction. Or you could even say there are a handful of corporations that are responsible for a lot of the destruction on the earth. But you know, there are always people who are affected by it, and there are people who have tiny footprints who are the most affected by the change, especially climate change, which is the unfairness of that is
usually marginalized and people of color.
So we have to acknowledge our varying degrees of implication, number one, and then also when we have use the resources that we have, especially people who live in countries like Canada or the United States, to support people who are actively working for change, as well as individual actions. You know, it makes a difference if you refuse to use single-use plastic. It makes a difference if you walk instead of driving a car. It makes a difference if you don't eat meat, you know, every day or once a week. You know, if you eat meat, if you become a vegetarian, all of these things are huge changes that you can make in your own life, and then connecting to collectives and people who are, you know, prosecuting polluters like Waterkeeper Alliance or Swim Drink Fish, or our friends at Environmental Defense or Ecojustice, who are actually using existing legislation and existing laws to punish polluters. That's important too. Let's support those people. There are so many different things, as Nick said, that we can all do, depending on where we are and what our resources are. I'm hopeful our role is to make people aware, to try to raise awareness, so that then the shift in, or we say the shift, a shift in consciousness is the beginning of change. When you're aware of your own implication in these landscapes that you would never see, and you see what they really are, I think that is the beginning of action. So hopefully.
Thank you both so much, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, I will start from here. I'm Fehmi Daud, a cinematographer of Honeyland, and we are from Skopje, Macedonia.
Hi, I'm Tamara Kotevska, one of the directors of Honeyland, and also from Macedonia.
Hi, I'm Ljubo Stefanov, co-director of Honeyland, from Macedonia also.
Atanas Georgiev, we are all from Macedonia. I'm the producer and the editor.
And my name is Samir Ljuma, I'm the other cinematographer of Honeyland.
And another person,
which is not here with us.
She's not here with us. She is not from Macedonia. She's from Lebanon. Ranait, our sound designer.
Amazing.
That's the old crew.
The whole crew.
Yeah.
Wow. So I feel so lucky to have all of you guys here. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're all busy, but also congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I saw it a couple days ago, and it was amazing. So beautiful. It just, and like I was telling you guys, like I'm a beekeeper, that's what initially drew me to the film, but I had to tell all my coworkers, like, you guys have to see this, and I was curious about their reaction to it as people that are non-beekeepers. So I guess to start, how did you guys find the story? How did you guys meet the main character? How did you guys get involved in this
Please,
project?
Please,
okay, so I will speak in his name now because he's actually the primary responsible person for finding this character. Mm-hmm. This actually all started as a different kind of project, like an environmental project for the territory where this village is. And in that period, we still didn't know Atice, the main character. But everything started when we discovered this beehives in the rocks. Mm-hmm. And from there, the curiosity happened, who is the person behind this, who makes this? Mm-hmm. And to meet this person and to realize how special she is was the main inspiration to start all of this, to go in the direction that mm-hmm. it's now.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a human story, mm-hmm. a real-life story. But it has an environmental, strong environmental message. Bees are, it's not about the bees, but the using of resources. Mm-hmm. The bees as producers of resources, such as honey, and the humans who are users of those resources. And the main environmental point is the principle of equal share of benefits. Mm-hmm. Between user and provider, for which ensures the food security in the future.
Right.
In the next season, in the next year, right. In the next.
And the importance, actually, of the bees for the entire planet. Mm-hmm. Somehow, Atice, our main character, is really special mm-hmm. because we learned a lot from her. I was not at all involved in beekeeping, or you know, I was not familiar with it. But what I've learned during the process of 3 years of shooting is really priceless for me, and how I started seeing the way how we should treat mm-hmm. the nature and. Everything that the nature gives mm-hmm. us. Like through the example of Atice, because in the movie it's very obvious how she sent the message that you always have to leave half for those who gives you, who provides you as a source, in this case the bees.
The resource.
The resource and the this message she tries to tell to the new nomadic family who are intruding the village and who are entering in her life, kind of, who started to harvest as well and to exploit actually the region mm-hmm. with the honey, mm-hmm. which endangered the bees that Atice, our main character, was taking
right.
care of.
Right. So, I mean, what was it like seeing her work in her hives for the first time, meeting her as a character, going on that cliff, going into, you know, the village where she's got...
That's how it started.
Right.
That scene is actually the first scene we shoot
it. It was very strange because we had a And it was, we didn't have any kind of security belt. It was like everything, just go move, take the camera on the hand and just record all those things that are happening in front of the camera. And when we started to open this cave, beehive, it was like, wow, we didn't see anything like that before in my life. And after some hours of the shooting in that beehive, they started to attack me. And I had four stings from that beehive, and I was just grabbing to get out of this cliff, and I just
climbed,
like,
it was really
like a dangerous
situation.
Right after that, we had already used to be in front of the beast, and we didn't have so much scaring about mm-hmm. situation about that. We used to it.
Yeah. So is that when you all got kind of hooked on Hatice as a character, seeing her?
In the first moment.
So amazing, yeah.
From
right?
The first moment.
Mm-hmm. So. As a beekeeper, a modern beekeeper, I guess, what most people use now, we have suits, we have veils, we have smoke, we have all this protection. I can't even imagine going on the side of a cliff.
We didn't
have. She only had a veil on, her hands were exposed, and...
Her face?
And
her
face.
You know, like, maybe, you know, we should... when we first time started shooting with her, we didn't know where we
exactly
lead.
Yeah.
Exactly we will lead to in this story in her life, because we were shooting for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I remember first time when we started shooting how she's opening and checking these beehives on the cliffs. I noticed that one beehive, there's like not that much produced honey, and in another one it was full with the honey and honeycombs.
Honeycomb.
So I asked Hatice, you know, like, how come, you know, like, here there was very little and here it's full, you know? I said, like, did you take it or something? She said, no, it's like the families. You have rich family and you have poor family. So very simple, she explained the whole circle, the way how the bees are functioning, like they really function like a human somehow, in working and providing for the queen bee.
Right.
And they're, you know, she told us that there is a special bees who are protectors, who are like army, who try to protect, which is the first line of the beehive. When the other bees will try to steal the honey, so we
right
measured.
Right bees and left bees.
She called them right bees and left bees, and she always tells us that you should be careful
with
the left ones. They
attack
really sting.
You know, yeah, the attackers.
Yeah. When that family started moving in, and she was telling, you know, the neighbors, you have to leave honey for your bees. Half of that needs to stay, and he didn't listen to her. And that encourages robbing, encourages them not having the resources that they need in his bees to go to her bees.
That's the main conflict.
But I just thought that relationship between her bees and his bees and their family and her little family, like that relationship was reflected in their bees, and I thought that was so interesting. And the way she takes care of hers in that traditional way, which allows for a slower process that yields ultimately more in the long run, and his is more speed, more capitalist money making, and that was his version of it. So, and then the conflict over those two ways of life, I thought was really fascinating, and illustrating that in nature too. It's a process. Not just in humans.
That's that important environmental message.
Mm-hmm. So can you guys, and I've heard some things from the panels and screenings that you guys have done for the film. You went into this wanting to follow her as a character, and you didn't know what you were gonna get.
No, we were prepared to stay there as long
as
a story.
Necessary.
Is it necessary?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we
spent 3 years there.
Actually, our producer and editor, because he can explain about the process of editing while we were shooting. Mm. So the end of shooting, actually, he forced us because, you know, like, we're already 3 years.
Well, those guys brought me 400 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's the biggest amount that I ever received. I've done so many films, but this was a really challenge for me.
Yeah.
And for example, I must say this, I felt it in this case, I was so amused, and somehow I felt this, that I have such a beautiful time, because as an editor, I felt that I have this big white canvas in front of me with so many colors, so I could do anything.
Anything, yeah.
So as while that they were shooting, so when if it was missing something, we would agree on something. Okay, let's focus on this. So let's start the searching the conflict on this point. So they would bring another material, so we would research it again. So we would, mm-hmm. and on the end. How can I say? They wanted to go again to shoot, and all the time they were wanted to shoot.
Get
more
addicted.
And more.
Yeah.
How far were you all from the village? How far
we
was
were,
that?
Look, that's the area, mm-hmm. the Honeyland area. Mm-hmm. It's actually an abandoned place in central part of our country. Mm-hmm. Actually, it is very close to the capital, and those planes. Which are in
scenes.
It shows that the airport is only 20 miles from her village. Mm-hmm. There is no road. They never had electricity, those mm-hmm. abandoned villages. They're abandoned since 1950s. And we were staying in tents in sessions of maximum 4 days, because no water, no electricity. We never had a
generator.
So when the neighbors moved in, you guys weren't.
It was first we started shooting with only with Atiche, mm-hmm. and our main idea was to make a short documentary about her, and they appear 3 or 4 months after mm-hmm. after we started.
It was not accessible, and it was like 2.5 hours drive from the capital. It was not very easy to reach because you need special vehicles, so like 4x4, and even sometimes in the bad weather conditions we were also not able, you know, several times we got stuck. For example, we received the information that her mom died, she called us. The crew went there and they needed to walk for 4 hours with the equipment because we didn't have proper car at that moment, and we couldn't arrange to get because we didn't had. So we were renting every time the 4x4
yeah.
car.
Yeah, and it sounds like you all became quite close to her. She
of
called
course.
You.
And we stay close.
Right.
Not only with her, with the family also.
Family. So,
I
okay.
want to add this, the closeness. We bought a house for her. In the nearest civilization, and for the kids we are raising a fund for a scholarship fund, and we will try to give a present to everybody that would like to give some donation to the kids. So we will try to provide a small jar of honey, and so the donators can have a little souvenir from it.
And we'll definitely put all that information on our
yes,
in our podcast.
This
is
very
important. Very
yeah.
helpful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyone, if you can check the website, it's honeyland.earth.
Right.
So they can find all the information about
right.
donating.
Yeah, and it's big help if the listeners can share this information, and hopefully they will have chance to see the movie.
See the movie.
Yeah.
I want everyone to see the movie. But as far as that the family goes, how was it developing this relationship with her, and then seeing this family move in and sort of, you know, it started out warm and friendly, and then there's this conflict that evolves. How was it to film them?
Keep in mind that we were there 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And we made a lot of material.
At first, of course, we approached her. And a lot later, we started communicating with the children, with the other family. And we didn't even have a plan for them to be part of, in the beginning, of course, to be part of the film, because we were just focused on her and her story.
And then when we discovered their conflict with the bees, this became a different, a lot stronger story. So we started calling them to like eat with us, started approaching them, and through a certain process of time, we got their trust and they opened to us basically. So every new time we went there, they wanted to show more.
Yeah, so. And the film definitely shows that. I loved her relationship with the, I don't remember his name, the one boy.
Muzaffer.
He was funny. He was so great. Especially with her mother being ill, she kind of took on this role, this kind of motherly or aunt figure who kind of showed him her way of doing things. And I think he really appreciated that, especially when they were, by the fire.
He was kind of the only one who understood the way how you should treat the bees. And because he was trying to explain to his father, don't take everything, And that's how it happened and everything how it is. But the family with 7 kids living in these conditions, in economically unstable environment, where you have to provide everything for your kids, we try to understand why he behaved like that. But that's why, for example, we started this donation process, so we can add to their education, because we think that education of these kids and any other kids to provide proper education for any kid actually can make a better understanding how we should treat the environment as well.
Yeah.
It was the new information of our day of premiere. The family with 7 children, they told us that Lutfia, mother, she born 8th child.
Wow.
Yeah, she got
so
the day
everything,
of premiere.
Yeah, on the day of the premiere. So everything that we trying to do it is to do maximum for this family.
Has the family seen the film?
Not yet.
Saw
the one part.
They saw the trailer.
They will see it
now.
On the premiere.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Let's copy.
Wow.
One more picantery. The mother, actually, that is present in the film, that died in the film in front of the cameras, actually died exactly 1 year before we have this premiere. Mm-hmm. And
on the same
hour.
On the same day.
The same day and the same hour. So I started being superstitious and to believe in this metaphysics in filming. So this is kind of a sign for all of us, like, ooh.
You got scared.
But I think that's going to be really special for Hatice to see her mother on film and remembered in that way, because their relationship was so interesting. She felt so much love for her mother, and you can feel it, but there was also, these two strong-minded individuals that are in such close contact with each other, they're inevitably going to have fighting, and, but it was so funny at times, too, and I think when she finally sees the film, it's going to be really special for her.
It was another point that in this documentary that is also hard, because I work a lot of years on films and documentaries. We have a birth in our documentary and death.
Yeah, with the calf.
It was like, we didn't know that we gonna have such a chance to shoot like this situation with the cow and with the mother. It was like, oh, come on, just do it. They called us. And went there and we had just opportunity to shoot 5 minutes. That was the only scene that we shoot it in. 3 or 4 shots, that was that, It was amazing to be part of this.
Right, that she allowed you guys to come in and film the mother.
She called us. And I'm lucky that I was not available at that moment, because it was like a last minute call. Mm-hmm. I was in another project, so Femi was the one who shot that scene.
We waited a long time, around 1 month, that she was very sick, and day after day we just as expected that she will die, and the day that called us and we just took out the equipment, went there, and it was like moment to catch.
It was very, later on we were discussing, I think that moment was something which left the most bitter taste for the entire crew, I think, for a while, because to be there,
probably
with the characters that you were spending the last 3 years, and to experience this moment was a bit emotional for everyone. You know, no matter how much or how we were sure that this will occur sooner or later.
If you saw it on the documentary, the mother, Nazife, didn't stand up from that chair, or how to say,
bed for four or five years.
She just all the time she sit there, lay there. She didn't stand up to walk around in front of the house. And after that, when she died, we saw that emptiness in this house, that it was like we had two lives inside, now they are only just one. And it's now moving on, she is not staying like there, she is continuing to live with that.
Right. So how is she doing now? You guys said you bought her house.
We are still, yeah, she's communicating.
She's fine, she's still moving, she's here and there.
Okay.
But we hope she will live Catalent forever, because there are no
And she will be close to her relatives.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Is she still beekeeping?
Of course, it was her life.
Yeah.
It was her life, that's the thing that she do the most.
Awesome.
Whole life.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for your time. And can you say again how people listening can donate to the fund for the children? And
It's www.honeyland.earth, like the planet Earth.
Awesome.
So just go visit our site and you'll find all the information you need.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you also.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel, William? I never went to secondary school. Make us proud.
Hey, looking sharp, eh?
You too, man.
Kachokolo is not the wealthiest school in the district, but it's down to each one of you to decide your own level of commitment.
Commitment!
The rains came late this year, and now the trees have gone.
Malawi is preparing for a very long, hungry season.
I saw the film at Sundance a few weeks ago, and I wanted to talk to you about it, and I guess just about, I guess I'll just jump in. So I guess, what is your stance on climate change? Because from, you know, coming from my background, the film, you know, all these issues going on with the family, and in the background is famine, and potentially famine caused by human impacted climate change. So I guess, what is your stance on climate change?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, I felt that the film had, when I read the book in 2009, I thought that it was it had a really important environmental message right at its center, right in the heart of the film, which has only become more relevant over that decade. You know, that obviously that combination of climate change, where people are no longer, especially in places where people are absolutely reliant on a consistency of weather and a consistency of weather pattern, and that shifting of weather patterns, that the nature of climate change is absolutely kind of undeniable, and it immediately affects these communities. And so in this iteration, in this experience, you know, that there's obviously that heavy rainfall that has come very late in the season, and then this drought hits, you know, just absolutely nothing, and very, very dry for a very long period. And that combination was the first kind of hit of this of the events that affected William Kamkwamba and his family and his community in Malawi. And the fact that those kind of events you know, are more and more frequent, you know, not just in Africa, not just in Malawi, but around the world. And that sense that the that is something that is on the increase and is clearly as a result of a changing climate. You know, their issue in 2001, 2002 was also, you know, there were other factors involved, you know, that, you know, the unregulated price of grain was another major issue that that affected that community. You know, there was that massive shortfall due to the harvest, and then grain prices just shot up in an unregulated way, which froze out the farmers. And so in 2009, we were dealing with the economic collapse, the global economic collapse, you know, that had happened in 2008. So again, this issue of climate change and this issue of economics, you know, were completely sort of interwoven in the experience that the Malawians had in 2001, 2002, and were part of, in some ways, the sort of global dialogue, you know, in different ways. And so because of that, you know, it seems that that sort of hydra, that kind of double-headed hydra, is exactly what is going to be and continues to be the sort of balance of figuring out who's being impacted by these issues, and often they're just the most kind of vulnerable communities, the communities that ironically do the least environmental damage, and, you know, and whether and what are the economic responses to that, to those issues as they happen, you know. So that was kind of, you know, that and sort of, you know, the environmental and the economic, and as well as the wider questions in terms of environment that I was intrigued by in the book, in the memoir, I wanted to represent in the film, which is deforestation, how that impacts the flooding, how that then impacts the harvest and so on, and just connecting all of that tissue. Malawi in this instance is a sort of microcosm of these kind of global dynamics and ways in which people are impacted by it, and ways in which governments don't engage in it, and how the economics freezes out the people affected.
And as you were saying, it's even more relevant today. You know, and it's amazing that this is based on a true story, which really hits home the fact that, you know, these communities, as you said, who are doing the least environmental damage, are being hit the hardest by climate change and incredible industrialization. So I guess, sure. having the stance that you do and being interested, I'm so glad to hear that you are as interested in environmental issues as you are, which is super obvious by the film. But I guess, how has your stance on climate change influenced the projects and the roles that you take on or will take on in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's a kind of case by case basis, you know. But that's what I wanted to do in many ways with this film, you know, that trying to create pieces of art, pieces of work that kind of can clearly start to tie in all of these sort of strands of the argument. And I think what's important to me is to tie them in ways that are undeniable, you know. But I feel like there are other ways, and there are other films that I've made that actually do kind of start to, in some ways, talk about these things. You know, I always felt like Zephyr Zachariah, even though it talks about a kind of an incident, which is a kind of man-made incident that destroys the environment, you know, it's a film I made, a Craig Zobel film that we made in New Zealand, that was with myself, Chris Pine, and Margot Robbie a few years ago. But I always felt like that had such a strong environmental element to the story, just the way that as people we encroach upon the environment, that we destroy it. And really, the sort of core root of what happens is, it's not, in a sense, about the planet per se, you know, because as in that film, the planet in some form survives. It may be damaged, it might be beaten up by human beings, but in some form it survives. What is really at risk is us. You know, well, actually what we're damaging is our capacity to live on this planet. And so some of the films, and that film in particular, you know, just really kind of hit home as well to that message, that in a way we're not just trying to save the planet itself, which is far more robust than we could ever imagine. What we're trying to save and spare is our capacity to exist on it. And in some ways, that's also what this film is talking about, you know, how these families and these communities are struggling against this, in this place that is changing for sure, but the nature of how it changes actually has this massive detrimental impact on human beings and human capacity.
Right. What I also loved, I mean, this was your first directorial debut, but I think it's just amazing to hear Black stories told by Black storytellers. And I guess I'm just wondering if you think, you know, the role that you had in this film, you were acting in this film and you directed this film, how that kind of influenced and shaped the way the film came out and the voice that you had. What's the importance of having Black directors tell Black stories and giving a voice to those kinds of important issues?
Yeah, I think that the kind of the charge and the challenge in a way of diversity in cinema and diversity broadly is that one is able to hopefully, and this is was the charge and the challenge of this film, is what you want to do is to enrich the kind of cultural, artistic landscape and the kind of, sort of wider cultural sense of art by telling stories from the point of view of the people who experience things, you know, from telling stories from inside the experience. You know, we're often, certainly when I was growing up, and I think most of the time, when we think about, when we see films that might reference or include something to do with famine or the struggles of rural communities in Africa especially, you know, we're often shown these things from the outside, from an outside perspective that is sort of looking, maybe empathetically, maybe sympathetically, maybe pityingly, you know, on the people, you know, and the focus is in some ways sort of what they are. You know, they are poor, rural people in such and such a country. You know, and the distinction of somebody, of having people who understand that community a bit better, that might be able to take us inside that community, is to change that question from not what they are, but who they are, and being able to talk about who they are really means being able to see that perspective from inside of it. What does it feel like inside of the family, inside of the community, to be undergoing these kind of pressures, to be fighting your way through, to find positive solutions, and to find inspiration from inside that community and inside that dynamic? And I think that is what is so rich about being able to have different voices and people to express their own opinions and their own understandings of different places. You know, Malawi is very different from Nigeria, but and there is no general African space. You know, there's no sort of generic Africa. You know, but when I was traveling back and forth as a kid, as a young man, to Nigeria and to the village in Nigeria, you know, I was aware of certain dynamics. I was aware of certain things. Some of those things are similar to the way things operate in the rural communities in Malawi. So I was able to find a way in, which I think is kind of often slightly more difficult if you haven't had any exposure to those kinds of worlds before, you know, that sense of the world before. So I feel like that's the real benefit of having those different points of view. It's like it allows audiences to have a rich cultural experience by going inside those kinds of dynamics and to see the world through the eyes of the people who experience certain things, and therefore have a richer appreciation of the world, a richer understanding of the world, a richer sort of knowledge of the world, which I think is one of the crucial things that art achieves or can achieve. And at its best, I think that's what it does achieve, is like we see the world in slightly different ways, which actually informs our overall understanding of the world.
Absolutely.
You know?
And it just becomes less anthropological, and that's kind of what I think most people are used to, especially when dealing with countries in Africa. So I just want to say again, beautifully done, and I really appreciated that we got to know his family so deeply in a way that I think is shaped by the fact that you are also an actor, but also a Black actor and a Black director, and you have, you know, that lens in which you're coming from. You've traveled before, and you say that you're that you've kind of been let in, but you also took the time to learn the languages there, and I just think that that really shapes the story in a really beautiful way. But I guess my last question would be, one of the big things, I guess themes that I saw in the film was William's father being this elder in the community, not the chief, but an elder in the community who has a way of doing things and has always done things a certain way. But those things are not working for him and his family in the village anymore. So I think that's sort of kind of like a big theme that's happening today is we can't do business as usual if we want to survive this current crisis that we're in. And we have a lot of youth that are kind of rising up and taking a stance and saying, no, we need to do something because I want to live in a world that I can survive in and then my children and children can survive in. So I guess the importance of elders listening to youth in these times, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that what I was really sort of going for, one of the themes of the film is this kind of intergenerational dynamic, you know, and how with Triwell that I play, you know, William's father, you know, that tension, you know, that kind of generational tension of wanting to hold on to one's sense of sort of, I guess, patriarchal superiority, you know, and how much of a stranglehold that has and that continues to become if you hold on to it, you know, without if you can't see that really you've got to be a member of your family, you know what I mean? You're not the head of your family. You've got to participate with everybody else, you know. And those sort of systems, a lot of the films sort of talks about kind of these systems, and one of those systems is how Triwell runs or thinks he should run, like his family dynamic. And that extends to all of these kind of patriarchal systems, the way the governments think that they need to run the and rule over the people, the way that all these sort of generational push and pulls happen, and how William is then stuck within the context of all of that, and how the solution starts to arrive when those kind of systems are pushed apart, basically, and those kind of systems are reorganized into better systems, essentially systems that can appreciate generations, can appreciate as the sort of elder dynamic, can appreciate the tradition, you know, can appreciate all of these things, even this kind of ancestral root from which we all kind of come from, you know, that they appreciate all that, but they embrace the future, that it embraces progress, it embraces new solutions to new problems, you know, and that, and embracing that, embracing the youth, embracing a younger generation, of being able to find a community and to find society and to exchange ideas properly in a proper forum without the kind of dictates of older ways of thinking is the only way that we can, as a community, start to find the solutions to the problems we face, you know. And ultimately, that's what William does. He does identify the problem, and he starts to find a solution to the problem, but it's only when he is able and embraced within the context of the society that the society in its totality can actually, you know, implement solutions to the problems. And that, for me, is a great metaphor for how we have to all sort of become William Kamkwambas in our own way. We have to identify the issues. We can't run away from it anymore. And we have to identify the solutions and decide collectively to live in the solution, to embrace the solution and march in that direction. And, you know, and I think that there's an incredible power with that, you know, and I don't think it needs to discard essentially anything. It's sort of just, is much more of a embracing, you know, that it's no longer this kind of heralded individualism, but it's a return to this idea of common values and sort of common benefits and, you know, embracing a sense of, you know, a real sense of community, a real sense of society, and thereby, you know, utilizing that to face down challenges.
Right. And not only embracing the William Kamkwambas of the world, but also giving the William Kamkwambas of the world the opportunity, because he's coming from this very rural village in Malawi, and, you know, he had this amazing experience and rose up in his community and was able to tell his story. But there's so many, you know, black and brown, poor, young people out there that have vision and intelligence, and they just literally lack opportunities. So I really
hope. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I think that's the crucial part of the story, you know, that talent is evenly distributed around the world, but opportunity isn't. And I'm finding a way to support young people, to support people who want to identify and implement the solutions to the problems that they face and need that support, need education, need to be able to be given and allowed to have the tools in which to really solve the issues that they are in, you know, is the way forward, to be able to work with that in an intergenerational way, in a global way, you know, to really face down these kinds of problems by coming to people and engaging with them as equal partners in solving these issues, you know, through education and support.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chiwetel. I appreciate this conversation so much. And thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm so glad that it's on Netflix and it's reaching this really large audience and more people can hear about William's story. And congratulations again on your first directorial debut.
Thank you so much.
That was my coverage of the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, featuring the voices of the filmmakers behind Anthropocene, Honeyland, and The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. I hope you enjoyed listening to our coverage, and if you haven't already, check out part one of our Sundance series by Kristen Tiesch in the previous episode. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Serena Simons, and our theme music today was by Unicorn Heads and Density and Time. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. It helps our listeners find the show as well as lets us know how we're doing. For more information about the resources voiced in this episode, head over to our show notes page at wildlensinc.org/EOC175. And as always, thanks for tuning in.